Welcome to the LSE Events Podcast by the London School of Economics and Political Science. Get ready to hear from some of the most influential international figures in the social sciences.
Hello everyone, good evening. This is a nice crowd, I can already tell. This is going to be a very interesting evening we're having. Welcome to the LSE for this evening's hybrid event hosted by the LSE European Institute and Jura, LSE's blog on European politics and policy. My name is Chris Anderson. I'm Ralph Dahlendorf, Professor of European Politics and Society in the European Institute here at LSE. I'm very pleased to be joined by, from your left, this means nothing politically, just spatially, Heather Graber, Tony Barber, as well as, of course, my LSE colleague, Sarah Horbold. I'll tell you about who these wonderful folks are in just a second. But before I do so, I'd like to ask you to please put your phones on silent, which I hadn't done, and I now have done, so that we can have a nice uninterrupted event. The event is being recorded and will hopefully be made available as a podcast, subject to the usual no technical difficulties. There will be a chance for you to put questions to the audience, to the speakers, of course. There's also an online audience. Participants can submit questions via the Q&A feature at the bottom of the screen. Please include your name and affiliation when you ask the question. And for those of you here in the theater, I will let you know when we will open the floor for questions. Okay. X users, which used to be Twitter for old people, the hashtag for today's event is hashtag LSE EU elections, LSE EU elections. All right, let me tell you about these wonderful folks on the stage here with me. So over here is Heather Graber, who's a senior fellow at, and then we debated whether it was Bruegel or Bruegel or Bruegel, but is of course a really, really well-known Brussels-based think tank, as well as a visiting professor at UCL here in London. She was previously director of the Open Society European Policy Institute after serving as a senior advisor to European Commissioner Olli Rehn on the Balkans and Turkey. Dr. Graber was deputy director of the Center for European Reform in London, and she conducted academic research at the EUI in Florence, Chatham House, Oxford, and Birmingham universities. To tell you a little bit more about who she is, she's a political scientist and has written extensively on the political economy of EU enlargement, the EU's external and neighborhood policies, and the evolution of new policy agendas in climate, digital, and the rule of law. Recently, she co-authored The Impact on the European Union of Ukraine's Potential Future Accession. Is that right? What's the title of the book?
It's called The Potential Impact.
Yes.
Or The Impact of Ukraine's Potential Accession to the EU.
Yes, that's what it was. Sorry, my notes are not quite right here. And also work on the European Green Deal. Then next to her is Tony Barber, who is European comment editor for the Financial Times. He writes extensively on European business topics as well as financial and political developments in the region. This is, of course, the kind of career that so many of us dreamt of, being a foreign correspondent, living in all these wonderful exotic places. He has been a foreign correspondent in Austria, in Belgium, Germany, Italy, Poland, the former Soviet Union, the US, and the former Yugoslavia. It's not a causal connection, really. He is a graduate of St. John's College, Oxford. Is that right?
Yeah.
And he achieved first-class honors in modern history. And he joined the Financial Times in 1997 as European news editor. Last but never least is Professor Sarah Horbold, who is the Sutherland Chair in European Institutions and Professor in the Department of Government. Previously, she's held posts at the University of Oxford, the University of Michigan. She is also, interestingly, for tonight's proceedings, the chair of the European Election Studies, an EU-wide project studying voters, parties, candidates, and the media in European parliamentary elections, and has received a number of scientific prizes for her work on elections, public opinion, and voting behavior in Europe. Wow. Okay, so you know you have a really esteemed panel here in front of you. And I thought we'd have a little bit of fun. I gave them some homework before we met for the evening. So I was hoping maybe to get back to the homework that I had posed. So India voted, right? Hundreds of millions of people went to the polls in India. Hundreds of millions of people will go to the polls in these next few days here in Europe. And I asked the panel ahead of time to give a think to the question of, what is the one thing that distinguishes this year's European parliamentary election from previous ones? Is there something that stands out to you as the defining factor or element of this campaign season? I thought we'd start right there in the middle of things and see what you think. Can I start with you, Heather? What's the one thing that stands out?
So I'm going to give you two. Sorry about that.
Ah, okay.
This is the LSE, you know, two for one special. So what stands out is the frenzied speculation about whether this is the moment when the populist radical right goes mainstream and really takes power in some way at EU level. And there's lots of speculation about it. I'm sure we'll talk at greater length this evening about how far that's likely to happen, and even if they get lots more seats in the European Parliament, how much does that matter? How much does that affect policy? But I just think that the way that the kind of normalization of the populist radical right in the media coverage of this election and also in the discourse among parties is really striking. You remember how Marine Le Pen, when she took over the Front National in France, she set out on a strategy of what she called dédiabolisation, really difficult word to use, but de-devilizing of the National Front. The idea was that she would make it no longer seeming like the devil in politics, no longer mainly about anti-Semitism. And she started going much more heavily on migration, and then that became much more of an anti-Muslim thing. Lots of other parties have now trodden that path as well, some more successfully than her. Think about Fratelli d'Italia, for example, in Italy. But they've never really broken through that much at European level. There have been far-right MEPs before, but this idea that they might be the third largest grouping in the European Parliament has really got everybody a flutter. It raises all kinds of questions about the role of the Parliament, as well as how party groupings are formed and can they work together and so on. But that, I would say, is really new. But the data point I would really like you all to think about, though, the other thing that's really important, it's not something that these elections are about, but is really important, is turnout. Because 2019 was the first election since the Parliament was formed in 1979 when turnout went up. There had been just consistent declines from 1979 until 2014, with the nadir in 2014 at 42% of Europeans turning out, and in some countries fewer than a quarter of voters turning out, only in eight countries did more than 50% of people turn out. And then in 2019, suddenly, there was this massive increase. So why and how is really important, and whether this election will continue that trend or revert to type is, I think, a really interesting question.
Thank you, Heather. Tony, over to you.
I think it's just on.
Yeah, well, good evening, everyone. For me, what stands out is the international context or environment in which these elections are taking place. It strikes me that it's never been so threatening than at any time since the end of the Cold War, probably in my experience, probably since the early 1980s, around kind of 1982, 83, when you had the kind of last seriously worrying moment of outright antagonism between Washington and Moscow. Now, in some ways, the dangers of this international environment have already become very clear, i.e. the Russian invasion of Ukraine, kind of more friction in the relationship with China, and everyone knows there's the risk of a second Donald Trump presidency. So people are aware of these risks. They haven't fed very much into the election campaigns, I would say, this time around in the EU, partly because, as usually happens, these campaigns are fought to a large extent within a national context in each country. Nevertheless, the awareness that something needs to happen after the elections, in, for example, to strengthen the European defence capacity, and this somehow needs to be done in a collective way to avoid this problem of fragmentation in defence procurement and so on. That that awareness is there. Related to this point of it being a very dangerous environment, I think are some other issues that are outside the traditional context of state-to-state hostility or alliance breakdown, as in the case of possible Trump presidency. And those are things like the problem of irregular migration, which is an asylum, which has not really been properly dealt with since the episodes of 2015, 2016 in the Mediterranean. There's climate change, where, although I wouldn't expect a reversal of what's been done so far, it isn't difficult to imagine a slowing down or tremendous difficulty in getting more done. And then there's the long-standing problem of the slow but remorseless decline in Europe's economic weight in the world, which is very striking compared with, say, the era when the first European Parliament elections were held, 79, I would say, to around the turn of the century. That matters because to the extent that your relative economic weight is in decline, then you aren't able to do things the way you want on a grand global stage in terms of things like business regulation, use of the latest technologies and so on. In many ways, Europe is behind others in this, particularly the US and China. So overall, it feels like a more threatening and challenging time for the EU than certainly I can recall.
Thank you. Now, so we hear about turmoil internally, turmoil externally, threats.
It's very hard going last because we didn't coordinate. So partly my points were similar to Heather, but I'll try and put it a little bit differently. When I thought about it was in terms of there's a real question about whether the center can hold this time. And I think that's because European Parliament elections have always been opportunities for voters to vote for the extremes, the left, the right, because there are, you know, as political scientists we like to call them, second-order national elections. They don't matter as much because they don't elect a government, or at least voters don't perceive the way in which they might elect a government. So it's an opportunity for voters to both express their preferences but also their frustrations with politics, and that has generally led to more extreme, more protest voting in the European Parliament. So that's not new. It's not new that often parties in opposition, smaller parties, challenger parties do better. I think in terms of the debate in this campaign, what's different is that whereas before Europe has really always been governed by a kind of big grand centrist pro-European coalition in the council, so it might be sort of center-left, center-right, liberal, and in the European Parliament, and these are the big political forces that have worked together. So there hasn't really been a sort of real government opposition dynamic. And then even though the fringes were there in the European Parliament, they weren't really that influential legislatively in terms of setting the agenda, other than how they might sort of indirectly influence mainstreams nationally. They weren't. And I think this time there's a question mark, and that's why I wanted to have it as the one thing, this thing, question mark over whether the center will hold, in the sense that it could be, if we look at all the forecasts, and just this morning, preparing for this event, I was looking at the latest forecast. And as Heather pointed out, they're all showing a shift to the right. And they're showing that what used to be the kind of median MEP, the middle one, would be a liberal, kind of a Renew ALDE sort of. And it's now going to be in, if the forecasts are right, and we like doing forecasts as political scientists, an EPP, a center-right. But that they will have a majority to the right. In other words, they can work without the center, without the center, without the liberals, without a centre-left. And that could, they don't have to, they can also continue to work with the centre, but you could have this kind of centre-right majority, and that could lead to a real policy shift. But this question of whether the centre, I don't think that would be a permanent sort of centre-right, right, radical-right coalition, but on certain issues, like what Heather is an expert on, like the European Green Deal, issues around migration and so on. But the other reason there's a real question over whether the centre can hold is in the interaction with the council and the national governments. Because again, we used to have centrist sort of governments on the whole. That, of course, we've had the radical right and the radical left in European politics for a very long time, but they didn't used to sit in the council. But now, of course, we have in Italy, in Slovakia, in Hungary, in the council, what we would call kind of populist radical right-wing heads of government. And we have soon a Dutch government with the largest party being a radical right-wing, upcoming elections in Austria, and France. I mean, of course, France is the center. You could have a Le Pen or radical right-wing president of France. And so all of a sudden, it's not just whether the center holds in the parliament, it's also there's a real shift in Europe where, for better or for worse, there used to be a sort of this big, grand, sort of mushy, you know, broadly kind of pro-European, we sort of agree on certain things, coalition running the thing, and that's how all these institutions kind of manage to coordinate amongst each other. But then you have now, I think that's a big question mark, because you're seeing some of these things shift, in part because the populist radical right is doing so well. Now, if I can add a little footnote to that, Chairman.
Yes.
That is that there has been a shift, though, in, I think, the radical right when it comes to Europe that matters for this.
Yeah.
So not, and it's not that they've necessarily moderated on immigration or moderated on a lot of other things, but they have taken, on the whole, a different approach to the EU.
Yes.
So Wilders used to be Nexit, and Le Pen was Frexit, and, you know, all these exits. And that was the way they saw Europe. We want to get out of it. It is terrible, regulatory, supranational, center-left blob. You know, the very epitome of the establishment, everything they were against. But I think now, partly because it's not so popular with voters, partly because Brexit looks like a complete disaster, and partly because actually they've perhaps seen that if Europe is shifting, it can also be a tool they can use. You could be used to have a fortress Europe. It can be used to roll back on climate. So most of the radical right, even though they're not sort of passionately federalist or pro-European now, are not exit Eurosceptics in the way they were, but much more seeing Europe as something that they want to change and control from within. So those are...
Thank you. That's very, very helpful. I think... obviously, all the participants will achieve a distinction with this answer. Since we're at LSE, we like to look into the causes of things as well, so we don't just give out distinctions. So if I think about the normalization of the populist right, and maybe the question around the extent to which citizens are engaged with this election, which goes to the question of turnout, when I think about what Tony just said, that the environment perhaps has never been so threatening. And if I think about the question around can the center hold, I think of those as symptoms, perhaps, of something, that they reflect something. Kind of what is underlying these outcomes you could perhaps think about, or these symptoms that you highlight as being especially salient or especially important in this particular European parliamentary election. If you could maybe spend a second or two thinking about kind of what drives this and not something else. One of the questions I thought about ahead of this panel was, what are the things that haven't come up? Which dogs haven't barked that you might have a year ago expected to be especially important? Farmers, we haven't talked much about farmers, I don't think, in this election, and things like that, things that were kind of in the news. And blah, blah. But going back to the question around causes and symptoms, maybe we can go in reverse order a bit, Sarah, to put you on the spot and give you a chance to go first. What drives it?
So, I can't I can't explain what drives the sort of international big context. I'll focus on what drives perhaps the particular factor that I outlined. So again, like speaking as a political scientist, I guess we think when we look at the rise of the populist right, that's of course not isolated to Europe, but what's really happened in Europe is we find it now almost everywhere. We can kind of think about like demand and supply factors. So some of the demand is like just the long-standing more electoral volatility where people's attachment to the big kind of centrist bloc, so you were born, let's say, center-left, social democrat, working class, voted for, you know, the Social Democratic Labour Party. You had a kind of, you were socialized into an attachment and you to certain big centrist parties. That has loosened. Or you were a Christian Democrat and you kind of came from a Christian Democratic family. It was, of course, never that simple. But there were quite strong party attachments that were rooted, as of, like sociologists would call it, in sort of big cleavages, socioeconomic cleavages that grounded people. Now, that has weakened in Europe. It's interesting with the country, sometimes we like to compare ourselves to the US, but of course what we've seen in the US for other reasons is a real hardening of partisan attachments. And in Europe we've seen a weakening. Now once you have that weakening, what happens is of course then that leaves more room for other actors to come in. And the in that space that's been left open, the populist radical right has been very successful in exploiting that. Why? Partly because they have politicized issues that are popular, that are kind of not traditional left-right economics, but more issues to do with identity and belonging. So in particular, people that perhaps felt that globalization and how the world was changing was not really going their way, mobilizing sort of saying, no, actually, we don't like the way our, you know, the world is changing. Has been a sort of very popular and is still a major issue in these campaigns is the issues around community, immigration, how do you want societies to look, but also what are the consequences for public services, for job opportunities, and so on. So I'm never one of these, so it's culture economics. I think these things are interlinked, and I think they're also interlinked with the degree to which the state provides what people feel it should. So they sort of do two things. They mobilize issues that people care about, and they also very successfully, and that's where the sort of populist side to it, is they speak to people's unhappiness with the establishment and these people, these other people who don't deliver for them, who is not them, and saying, no, you can be empowered because we are standing for you, the people. So I think they have been very successful as what I might call sort of the political entrepreneurs coming into that space. And we see that now, and also very adaptable. So, for example, now the EU being against the EU in a sort of traditional way is perhaps not successful. So then they adapt and say, no, we're going to be more anti-immigration from within the EU. So they're quite adaptable actors. So I think there's both these sort of long-term trends, but also more short-term in that they have just been able to capture some of that unhappiness with how the establishment hadn't delivered, and unhappiness with some ways in which society has changed in a sort of post-war era.
Just to follow up on that really quickly, doesn't that beg the question of why the mainstream parties have failed so spectacularly as incumbents, as the owners of institutions, as the being sort of in the driver's seat, right? Why have they been so, I mean, you saw this in the US as well. I think if you think about the Democratic Party losing a lot of its core constituencies among blue collar workers and those kinds of folks, why have they been so blind to it? Have they been so, failed so miserably? Maybe I could throw that to Heather, who also spoke about kind of the normalization of, for something to be normalized, somebody else has to have not done their job, so to speak.
Well, I think it's also because the left-right divide, which was a very familiar way of thinking about politics after the Second World War, well, before as well, but particularly since 1945, has started to break down because of the way that economies have changed. So neoliberalism became the dominant economic ideology, and it meant that the center-left bought into the idea that capitalism delivers for people and stopped really offering an alternative after the collapse of communism and state socialism in 89. So we had the third way, Die Neue Mitte, all of this shift of the centre-left towards embracing capitalism and just trying to kind of soften the edges of it. So they didn't really offer alternatives to the economic model, which was not delivering for a lot of society. And also, when globalization during the past 30 years increased inequality a great deal, there's a fantastic book title by Colin Crouch, another political scientist, called The Strange Non-Death of Neoliberalism, which is kind of, you know, how is it that inequality has increased dramatically, insecurity, precarity has increased hugely, and yet neoliberalism has still riding high, and centre-left parties embraced it as well. So this lack of such a clear and distinct set of positions between left and right in the centre then led to the extremes where both parties of extreme left, think about Mélenchon in France, for example, and of the extreme right, actually had quite similar economic policy prescriptions, which was protectionism, no, we don't want free trade. We do actually want much more state intervention in the economy. And so that meant that the sense of are the alternatives about economic policy became less important, less salient in elections. And the elections started to be contested on very different grounds. And I think this shift in the grounds of contestation towards issues of identity, culture, changing society, you know, changing world, as Sarah was saying, became very significant. And that was to the benefit of the populist radical right, who, while they were not in power, were able both to put forward much more radical economic policy. I mean, these were not costed, elaborated economic policies, but they were able to put forward, should we say, slogans about, you know, the economy should be protecting people, the economy should be delivering people. You know, we should stop the Chinese being able to come into our market, and the Americans, by the way, you know, said Le Pen. Or we should leave the euro. That came long before the idea of Frexit. She was already saying that in quite shortly after the euro was introduced. So she could come up with something very radical, because there was no risk that she would get into power and actually have to deliver anything very much. And they could play with things like migration without thinking about the economic consequences. Now, I think that is the really interesting area where they're going to have to change. Because as the center, will the center hold, as I was saying, and as the international environment is more threatening and so on, populist radical right parties are beginning to come into power in countries at just a moment when they actually need to take some really difficult decisions on really big issues. So Giorgia Meloni, for example, came into power in Italy and actually had to decide, am I going with NATO and supporting Ukraine? Am I going with Russia? Now, she, in fact, has actually had quite good form on being quite consistent about being anti-Russia, pro-NATO. That would be much more difficult for Marine Le Pen if she wins the next French presidential election. What kind of a volte-face, what kind of acrobatic act is she going to have to do on international issues? Very tricky, especially if she is, in fact, being bankrolled by Russian banks, you know, all these questions about party financing and so on. So I think what's going to be really interesting is whether the populist radical right parties that get into power, and by the way, there's not really much chance of populist radical left parties getting to power. That happened in Greece with Syriza, and they became quite moderate. That they're very, in other countries, very few opportunities to do that. But the populist radical right taking power, then they have to choose. Do they go the Meloni route of becoming much more moderate, working with European partners, and then at home focusing on a few issues that are important for their electorate, like in the case of Meloni, allowing anti-abortion campaigning inside hospitals, or, it's sort of... She's got a very interesting position on labour migration that we could go into. Or do they do like Geert Wilders, where his party is part of the coalition, he's done really well in the elections, but he avoids actually taking the reins of power and having to moderate. He wants to stay the radical, shouting from the sidelines, complaining about the establishment, using the grievances. They have this very difficult choice to make. Some of them have actually segued, you know, Meloni has segued remarkably smoothly. Others are finding it much harder to do that, especially especially because on economic policies, often within their own parties, they have very different views. Some are quite radical libertarians, wanting free trade and very little regulation. Others want to be quite protectionist and want much more state intervention. So I think what's going to be interesting is to see how do they behave. You know, it's a bit like if any of you have ever been at a school where somebody who had a really radical kid becomes the head student, they become like the student president of the school, and they like suddenly have to do stuff, and it's like a horrible shock for them. I think it could be really interesting to see how each of them plays this in the different countries.
Thank you. Going back to the question of causes of symptoms, yeah. Tony, what do you think?
Well, let me focus my answer on East Central Europe and Russia, which is probably the area of Europe I know best. Spent a lot of my career. I'll divide it into three parts. There are the countries of that region which joined the EU between 2004 and 2013, in Croatia's case. And then there's the aspiring member states, a little bit further to the east and southeast. And then lastly, there's Russia. Now, in the case of the countries which, after the end of communism, eventually joined the EU, we need to ask ourselves, what was 1989 for them? Yes, it was partly the desire to enjoy the liberal values and human rights that they'd seen in Western Europe. It was partly the economic prosperity they'd seen in Western Europe. But it was also crucially about national independence, either regaining it, being lost to Nazi Germany or the Soviet Union in the past, or in some cases gaining it for the first time. Some like Slovenia, for example. Now, national independence and individual freedom and liberalism are not necessarily exactly the same thing. And if you look at what independence meant for some of the countries in this region, it actually clashed with some of the obligations that they quickly saw would arise as a result of EU membership, above all on something like asylum burden sharing and migration. Because the promise of 1989 for a lot of these countries was the promise that President Wilson offered in 1918. It was, you get your own state and it's one nation for one state. It's not about having a multicultural country at all. It's about, and after the huge population transfers at the end of the Second World War in countries like Poland and Czechoslovakia, the new leaders and the populations of those countries said, phew, thank God, we don't have any more horrible Germans going to subvert our new independent state anymore. God, what a relief. After 1989, after EU membership 2004, suddenly they're being told to take it. They don't like it. Now, that was one problem for these countries that joined the EU. Another, looking at it from the EU's perspective, was once they're taken in, how do you exert the leverage to make sure that they obey some of the rules of membership? The crucial thing being things like corruption and the rule of law. And you look at the attempts to sort out what's been going on in Hungary, I mean, at the end of the day, they haven't really got anywhere. And then somewhat under the radar, there's an enormous problem in Bulgaria. Mm-hmm. I mean, politicians and business figures get sanctioned by the US Treasury these days, you know? And what happened? I mean, one of the reasons for that, by the way, is that the Bulgarian centre-right party, GER, which is likely to be re-elected right now, this very weekend, had political cover from Angela Merkel's Christian Democratic Union, which valued the votes and the general political alignment of Boyko Borisov's party with the CDU and the centre-right more broadly. So that was another problem. And then lastly for these countries, another issue was the fact that the transition from communism to a in quotes free market involved an awful lot of insider dealing, an awful lot of winners who gained from having access to the privatizations and the new avenues for profit, and there were an awful lot of losers, and the losers are precisely the people who these parties that Heather and so I've been talking about can appeal to in an election. So these are some of the problems that have arisen that complicate EU policy making and and a cohesive attitude to the rest of the world. Now, if you look at the next region, the countries that are aspiring to join, the problem here is that really, ever since 1990, they've been a kind of badlands area, borderland that is neither wholly embraced by the West, even though some countries, of course, are in NATO, let's say not wholly embraced by the EU, rather, but neither fully aligned with Russia. And the attitude of the EU, despite having laid out some 20-odd years ago in Thessaloniki, I think it was, wasn't it? Yes, your road to the EU, yeah, we're guaranteeing it. You know, it wasn't that long ago when Jean-Claude Juncker was the European Commission president that he said, I think we'll take a pause on, you know, enlarging, actually. I mean, nobody really wants it. You've seen a reaction, particularly in countries like the Netherlands, France, over time, but others as well, where you think, you know, this is all going to be too much trouble and we'll probably have to pay huge amounts as well. So even though there appears to be more momentum behind enlargement into southeastern and east, you know, now, I'm not so sure once the bill comes out. Not only does it require a great deal of internal reorganization inside the EU, but actually there are some countries nominally aspiring to join the EU, which, when you look a bit more closely, aren't doing anything at all to justify entry, or even are going backwards, like in Serbia. So that is another reason for the climate of instability in international relations. This area, it remains contested between Western democracies and Russia, but and the path into integration is uncertain. Lastly, there is the Russia, and the thing I would say here is that I think there have been very, very serious misunderstandings of precisely where Russia was going domestically and in its foreign policy ever since the collapse of the Soviet Union. Inside the EU and inside certain national governments, particularly those of France and Germany, the misreading was frankly astonishing. And only now are we beginning to kind of gather up the pieces from this disastrous misreading of Putin in particular. But actually, you know, even before Putin, there were signs that there was going to be trouble coming in the future. And one of the consequences of this French and German misreading of Putin in particular is that although there is a more generally agreed common line in the EU towards Russia now, basically most of the Central and East Europeans still don't trust the Germans at all when it comes to Russia policy. So that is a big problem when it comes to common EU foreign policy, which is what you know, what you really do need in this threatening world.
Thank you. That's very, very interesting. So before we throw it open to the audience, I think we have a few more minutes to have a chat amongst ourselves. I was going to get into the sort of European Parliament elections more directly and speak a little bit about what they mean, what's likely to happen, what are the consequences of it all. Maybe start with Sarah, who wrote a book 10 years ago titled Blaming Europe? You may remember, responsibility without accountability in the European Union. Wonderful title, of course. But in it, you argue that European voters are not able to hold the EU representatives to account by the ballot box in European elections, of course, because there is no identifiable European government to be rewarded or punished, as you mentioned earlier already. So they're unable to sanction an EU incumbent who isn't performing, and you argue that they lose trust in the EU as a result. So taking a step back from that, sort of what kind of elections are they then? Right? We don't elect a government. They're sort of like a second-order election, as you were mentioning earlier. They take the pulse of where we are in any one of the 27 member states. Is that the best way to think about them?
I mean, I think it's interesting when you just look at this sort of justification for why we have a European Parliament and why it's become more and more powerful as a legislative actor, is that they always, of course, justified it in terms of we are the voice of the people. So it's always in terms of democratic legitimacy. When we look at a lot of other institutional developments in the EU, like moving qualified majority voting, expanding the number of policy areas. It was often because of some efficiency arguments of the ability to solve policy problems. I don't think there's a lot of arguments about, oh, we need a stronger European Parliament, primarily because it makes us better able to make decisions more efficiently. It has been about we're representing the citizens, and why do we need to represent the citizens of Europe? Because what the EU has done with its further deeper integration and taking over more policy areas is it has, in a sense, weakened national parliament at the expense of national government and at the expense of EU institutions. So I think that's often been a part, big part of the rhetoric. And then I guess what you're asking me, has that been successful? Now, I don't think it has, from a sort of looking at it in terms of, has it provided more legitimacy for the EU? It might have, in fact, indirectly, I think, represent the preferences of citizens in some way. So there is a kind of indirect role. But in terms of making people feel like, now I know when I vote, if I was Dutch, could have voted today, this is how this will change Europe, I'm not so sure I would know. And part of it is exactly because of this sort of blob of this sort of, you know, I'm all for the blob, I'm definitely somewhere in that blob, so I'm not sort of talking, but it's this kind of big grand coalition that's sort of ruling things. So what do you then do if you're not happy with things? Well, you go, for example, and vote for the radical right, yeah? Because they're not a part of that. Maybe they will be now, but they weren't. And so I think that's all you do, what you were sort of suggesting, is you just think, oh, the EU thing is just terrible, yeah? I want to repatriate my powers, perhaps if I, you know, in the past, perhaps I just want to leave the whole thing, or at least I want the powers back to something I understand, because I don't understand. You know, I hardly understand it, and I, you know, have studied it for 20 years, but and I don't understand how I can influence what happens in Europe as a citizen. And so then I just become anti-European. So for example, if I'm now really unhappy, so I think Britain is always this complete contrast to that. Right now, if I'm really unhappy with things, and we know a lot of Brits are really unhappy, I mean, it's pretty clear what they can do, and they're going to do it on the 4th of July, yeah? They're going to vote the Conservatives out of government. Does that mean Labour will make them deliriously happy? Probably not. I mean, that's my prediction. But the thing is, there is accountability there. Yeah, you can vote for a party that's not in government, and something is going to happen. I mean, maybe not much is going to happen, but certainly you're going to get a completely different government, and that's what, you know, I think most forecasters will tell you. But do I know if I'm Dutch now what's going to happen, or if I'm any European citizen what's going to happen? So I think those are the kind of extremes. Now, are there downsides to having that kind of majoritarian? Would that majoritarian model work in the EU? Absolutely not. And Heather's a Belgian citizen, and you also have a very model system in Belgium, exactly when you have these very divided societies. So I understand why it has arisen, but I'm not sure the European Parliament has ultimately succeeded in providing that sort of legitimacy for the EU as an institution.
Hmm. Interesting. So, continue on that thought of what is going to happen, what might happen, or what is the consequence of all of this. Tony, you wrote last week that Meloni, she's come up several times already, Giorgia Meloni, makes no secret of her ambitions for her party and the hard right pan-European group of which it forms part after next elections. She would like to overturn the long-standing domination in the European Parliament of the center-right European People's Party and the center-left Socialists and Democrats group. She recently called this an unnatural majority, and she said it should be replaced by a broad coalition of the right, including her party, that excludes the left from power. Do you think that's going to happen?
On balance, probably not, but, you know, there's a chance. But on balance, I think it probably won't. Just briefly, while there are some people in the European People's Party who think that she's and her party are sort of acceptable to work with, there are others who don't. So, you know, you've got an argument going on there in the EPP. And then on the, you know, what we sort of broadly might call the hard right, there are some personalities and parties that that Fratelli d'Italia and Meloni personally could work with, but there are others that she definitely couldn't. So, you know, getting some sort of consensus and the necessary compromises to build something out of all that, I think it would be pretty hard, actually. Which is not to say that I share Sarah and Heather's views that on certain issues facing the EU as a whole, you could get ad hoc cooperation between the centre-right and parties further to the right. It definitely you could. Mind you, a lot of these parties, and Heather's written quite a bit about this, you know, these parties on the sort of hard right extreme, right? I mean, their attitude to a day's work in the European Parliament is quite interesting. I mean, they might show up for a couple of minutes and then just disappear, and the voting records are very wayward. They like, you know, to kind of load something up to put on YouTube or whatever. So, you know, the hard work that's needed to kind of affect legislation in the detail, they don't seem to do, you know, in some cases hardly at all. So, you know, I don't think I'd expect a radical sort of wrenching of policies out of sync, but on certain pieces of legislation you could see them blocking or overturning perhaps.
Well, one of those issues has been the environment, right?
Yeah,
so
definitely.
Ursula von der Leyen's quest to be renewed as Commission President has given rise to discussions around sort of, you know, the European Green Deal and the extent to which, you know, we need to push it hard and far, because she needs, apparently, legislators from the right to support her bid. Mm-hmm. You've done work on the environment, and I think you said, I found a quote by you, leaders are trying to find their way through the trade-offs and trying to get the public on board for the transition. They're trying to have it always, it sounds like. By kind of tiptoeing around and just presenting a little bit here and a little bit there, leaders don't satisfy at all the youth climate activists and those who are looking at the signs and saying, wait a minute, it needs to go so much faster and so much further. But at the same time, they're contending with certainly a bit of a backlash against some of the policies being proposed and being put in place now. We've seen this in the Netherlands, we've seen this in other places. Mm-hmm. So do you think this election will retard and slow down Europe's ambition, its ability to actually fulfill its ambitious goals on the environment?
Mm-hmm. Well, it matters a lot because of the effect of the results of the European Parliament elections on the choices of the people to run the Commission and the Council, the European Council in particular. And so I think that's where it would have more of an impact. So in the last 5 years, the Green Deal was mainly about a very large amount of legislation, which was in order to reach climate targets that were set, quite ambitious climate targets across a wide range of areas, which are now legally binding. So that means member states are legally bound to implement them. But of course, they've got to do that with funding that they have to raise. And at the same time, the EU has new fiscal rules that make it harder for them to raise extra money. So I think one of the big trade-offs for the next term is going to be about the obligations to reach various climate targets, which in my view, in the view of the scientists who work on climate, say we've really got to meet those targets, especially because Europe is warming at twice the global average, and we're actually getting some of the major climate impacts already in the form of floods, you know, droughts in Spain and then floods in Germany, the Netherlands and elsewhere. So, but the problem is, how do governments do that when A, they've got new fiscal rules that make it harder for them to raise money at national level, and B, they've got more spending on things like defence in order to reach the NATO target of 2% of GDP spending on defence and defend themselves against Trump's accusation that they're not pulling their weight on Ukraine. And also, it's about both arming Ukraine and also building up national defences. So this international threat environment that Tony's referring to, it's kind of presented often as a trade-off with green spending. Now, I would argue these are two threats that are both there, and the climate change does not go away simply because Putin invades Ukraine, but it does mean that arguments about cash and about public spending at both national and EU level are really going to dominate the next term of the institutions. And in that period, we will also have a new budget, a new EU budget, the multi-annual financial framework. Now, the EU budget is only about 1% of EU GDP. It doesn't have massive redistributive impact. So it's not going to satisfy the people who feel that cost of living has gone up, that they inequality has increased, and so on. The EU doesn't do redistribution. This is one of the reasons why, for what Sarah was describing, the way that people feel dissatisfied with the EU, but they can't hold people to account. But also, the EU can't deliver to people things that they feel in their daily lives that matter to them, like unemployment insurance or health. You know, health coverage. You know, the EU managed to deliver vaccines during the COVID epidemic, but that was a real kind of anomaly. The EU doesn't have powers in areas that people feel most in their daily lives because the member states want to keep that at national level. So that means the EU doesn't offer reassurance that, okay, you know, there's a war going on right on our border, and we've got a green transition to get through where you don't know how that will affect your job and the economy as a whole. But the EU can't provide any kinds of reassurances about how to finance either of those things, unless, and this is the big question, in addition to, unless there's, two things could happen. One is that the budget is really radically reformed to reduce the EU funding for farm subsidies, which is still about 30% of the budget. It's about a third of the budget, and kind of 75% of the budget is farming subsidies plus the regional funds. What if those were radically reformed to provide more money for defense, for joint procurement of armaments, for also for the green transition, and also for social measures? You know, that would be very radical. But it's the first time I've heard ever in my, you know, many years studying the EU, serious talk about a much more radical reform of the budget. For example, introducing co-financing for agricultural subsidies in order to free up money. That would be radical. But the other thing that might happen, and which I think will be a recurring debate and discussion over the whole of the next term, is the idea of debt financing, of doing something like, again, like what the EU did for the very first time ever during the COVID epidemic, which is doing joint borrowing on international markets. That was for the Recovery and Resilience Fund. So now that precedent has been set, that always looks appealing. And if we think about some of these divisions, the kind of new issues that we've been thinking about, populist radical right, quite a lot of those parties would be perfectly happy to have more EU level financing of things that they, to give them money at national level. Wouldn't that be great? And it's also even the kind of more anti-EU leaders like Viktor Orban would love to have EU money. So those who are very anti-establishment and even anti-EU are still very happy to have EU money coming in. So I think that's going to be a really big debate. And whether that will appeal to the public, I don't know. I haven't seen any studies about how much the Republic Recovery and Resilience Funds, Next Generation EU, all this extra EU money, whether that has affected public opinion at all. I don't know.
Yeah, if I just come in with a few words on what Heather said. I mean, Heather mentioned as likely spending priorities, defence, green policies. There's another one, actually, which is massive industrial and technological investments, a little bit along the lines of what the Biden administration has done. Emmanuel Macron's proposed this. As Heather said, where is this money going to come from if you have fiscal rules that basically say you can't do this, you can't do that? And there are all these other pressures on governments to maintain, you know, what they currently spend on this rather distinctive form of European welfare capitalism, you know, the generous welfare state, housing, transport, education, all this. Well, everybody likes borrowing, you know, it's going to debt. If you look at the general or average levels of GDP, debt to GDP ratios per country, I mean, in the last 30 years, they've just boomed, you know, everywhere. And so, you know, it is quite possible that they'll go, oh, well, we'll just, you know, do it under some new EU financing thing. But the problem, there's a couple of problems with this. One, the current German coalition has as its finance minister a man called Christian Lindner, who goes, no, we're not doing this at all. So you've got to get around that. The second thing is, as far as I'm aware, there's no agreed plan on how to repay the debt of the recovery fund, which has to be done up to 2058. That's got to be sorted out.
Yeah.
I mean, how that's going to happen, I don't know.
But that's way beyond the life of any incumbent government. So
Indeed. No, but it is a really, really big issue. Where do you raise the money for all these things?
Could I just add one tiny point, which is another thing that I think there will be a lot of call for more EU spending on is climate adaptation, precisely because climate change is really affecting the European continent more and more. Slovenia lost 16% of its GDP last year from 48 hours of heavy rainfall because it caused such massive flooding. It's really, really expensive to just allow climate change to happen. Really expensive, and it will become more so. So I would predict that when we sit here in 5 years' time and we have a big LSE debate on the 2029 European Parliament elections, there will be, by that point, some kind of EU fund for climate resilience, civil protection, disaster relief, and infrastructure resilience, or something like that. It'll be an internal version of ECHO, which is the humanitarian and disaster relief thing that the EU has externally.
Interesting. So let's turn it over to the many young folks who will probably be thinking about that election and what is going to happen to the future. If there's questions from the audience, we'd love to hear them. Over here.
Thank you very much for this really interesting panel. My name is Leah. I'm at the European Institute. And I was wondering if you could maybe expand a little on the impact of the elections on Ukraine's accession. You already mentioned Ukraine, but does the configuration of the EP impact the Ukraine accession? Thank you.
Thank you, Leah. Maybe we can collect a couple of different ones. Any other questions? Here.
Thanks for a great panel. Paul, also from the European Institute. I was wondering about the political agency of the right at EU level, because I think, Tony, you were talking about the cohesiveness, let's say, of the right-wing group, of the ID group in particular, maybe in the European Parliament. And I was listening to Simon Hicks's prediction, and he reflected on the Greens and how they used to be this quite chaotic and not very cohesive group in the European Parliament, but who became extremely cohesive by now with the prospect of power and with the prospect of influence. And when I think then about the normalization of right-wing politics that Sarah talked about in various European countries and about the Economist cover, I think, from 2 weeks ago, isn't the question not so much if we should fear for the right to take power in... What was I going to say? I was wondering if the prospect of a cohesive right-wing group in the European Parliament isn't much more likely than we might think of on the basis of previous parliaments.
So we've got Ukraine, we've got the cohesiveness and the coherence, perhaps, of more right-wing parliamentarians in the European Parliament after the election. A third one, or are we going to take these? There's one more here.
Hello, my name is Thomas, and my question is, how would different parties alongside the left-wing to centrist parties in general, how would they react both similarly and differently to each other on the European stage?
So heterogeneity among left parties, one could call that question. So how about, who wants Ukraine?
I'm not entirely convinced that the European Parliament elections in themselves will be decisive in affecting Ukraine's accession bid. I mean, really, what is going to matter is the outcome of the war, I would have thought. because outright defeat for sure will kill the accession bid, but even something that leaves Ukraine partly occupied and partly under Russian influence, that would also be very, very awkward. So it does boil down to can Western support for Ukraine that's beginning to revive a bit after the Biden administration's ability to end the deadlock over this in Washington, as that starts to kind of flow back, can the Ukrainian war effort gain momentum again? That will be the question. And related to this is obviously the outcome of the American presidential election in November. And I think you never know for sure, but I somehow doubt that a second Trump administration would be so committed to supporting Ukraine. You just don't know, of course, with him and who he would appoint, but I doubt it. So if there was a question mark over America's commitment, I can't see. I know some deeply committed supporters of Ukraine and Europe, particularly in Central and Eastern Europe, would say, look, we've got to carry on because it's just an existential question. But I think it would be very, very difficult for the EU as a whole to maintain a strong foot. So you're looking at two things, the war effort and the American election, for me.
I would just add, the European Parliament has only two really decision-making powers on this. One is about money, year to year, so it does matter, the Parliament would have to approve funding to Ukraine. But that's already being fought so fiercely in the Council that the Parliament is not so important there. But the key thing that they have is the Parliament has to ratify the accession treaty. So at the end of the process, the European Parliament and every national parliament has to give its assent to a new country joining. And that can be very tricky, but that's unlikely to happen in this term because I think Montenegro is the closest to getting towards the end of negotiations, and even I think it's unlikely to happen before 2029. I think it would be in the next term, probably 2030, which has been mentioned by various people as a first date, a potential date for Ukraine. Ukraine might, I think, will struggle, even if the war ended soon and favorably for Ukraine, it would still struggle to get to be ready by 2030. Montenegro really might be, but then it's up to the EU whether they let them in. But those are the only real powers that the Parliament has. This is a game, enlargement is an intergovernmental game, mainly. It's the Commission that runs the process of negotiations, but it's the Council, it's the Member States that really keep a grip on, of control on the whole process.
So going to Paul's question about, are you saying these conservatives that are described as perhaps somewhat less than enthusiastic about legislative work and showing up and getting things done, you're saying, well, once they have a chance to run the institution, maybe they'll get their act together and act more coherently and responsibly? Is that sort of the intuition? What do you think?
I mean that makes sense. No, I mean, I think we were sort of describing how they have been isolated. It makes sense for them to use it in a performative manner if they knew they weren't going to be part of fundamental coalitions and all of a sudden. I mean, there's certainly more, you can see it with someone like Meloni. I mean, she's serious about having power in Europe, and you could imagine it with a Le Pen. So I think your intuition is right. I mean, Tony is also right. If you look statistically over, as I'm sure you've done, over kind of since 79, you have by far the lowest, also cohesion in vote in that group or in those groups compared to the others. So in that sense, yes, they haven't been as effective as they could. Will they become more effective when they can see A, it will make a difference, B, they're like more professionalized because they're also national government? I think that's probably right. However, there's still quite a lot of heterogeneity in that group and on a lot of issues. I mean, you have certain parties that are normalizing and seeking power. And then you have like the AfD that you would, it's a very interesting case, I think, in terms of a radical right-wing party that's growing more and more popular and also seem to be growing more and more radical. Mm-hmm. And so radical that even Le Pen, I guess strategically at least, thinks they're so radical that they should kick them out of ID, a group. So, and that might be strategically quite clever, because I think it'd be very hard for the EPP to work with ID in any way if AfD was part of it. So actually kicking the AfD out, because Germany is of course one of the few countries that still have a kind of quite strong norm around we don't work with the radical right. I mean, that's gone in almost every other member state, even the Swedes for ages. They were like, oh no, we'd never worked with the Sweden Democrats, just until they needed the votes to form a government, and all of a sudden it was fine. And so Germany still has that sort of norm in place. And so in a sense, isolating the AfD might be, in fact, make it easier for the center-right to work with the rest. But I think your intuition is right. Yes, they will become, probably take the legislative work more seriously if they think that they can take them somewhere, and also just the general part of these parties are becoming bigger and more professionalized. But there are still quite big differences between these parties on a lot of number of issues, and one of the issues is of course the one we just touched upon in terms of accession, which is, you know, are they kind of, do they love Putin or do they hate him? I mean, they're not quite on the same page with that, for example.
I mean, by definition, these parties claim to represent their own nation, and therefore the risk of some sort of clash of interests with a similar party representing a different nation is fairly obvious. A very amusing example of this came a few weeks ago when Marine Le Pen was visiting the French Indian island possession of Mayotte. And while she was there, somebody in the AfD submitted a question in the Bundestag, I think it was, suggesting that Mayotte maybe shouldn't really be French. There has been some stuff at the United Nations over the years about the French ownership. But you can imagine, so Le Pen, when she was in Mayotte, and she went, How dare the AfD start? Who are they to start talking about, you know, French possession like this? So you see the sort of trouble that can arise there. Just the last thought, you know, defining exactly where each of these parties is on the spectrum is terribly difficult. Yeah. Giving them a kind of simple label, you know, that never really works. But I would mention that in my own view, at least, in the case of Fratelli d'Italia, you know, if you trace their history back to the early years of restored Italian democracy after the 1948 constitution, let's say, you see that the origins of this party, you know, it's quite complicated, but as time passed, layer after new layer of non-fascist background was added to it. So it's not a pure neo-fascist party. It has elements in it of more sort of conservative, even sort of old monarchist even, but a kind of right-wing approach that's not seen as beyond the pale. And of course, since the collapse of what is sometimes called the Italian First Republic after the end of the Cold War and the emergence of Berlusconi, the party that is the ancestor of Fratelli d'Italia, has been in government. So Italian voters themselves regard this party as a perfectly normal element of the scene, in total contrast to AfD, which is, it's under investigation, or parts of it are at least, for subverting German democracy. Nobody in Italy thinks Fratelli d'Italia is subverting Italian democracy. In the years when I worked in Rome, the party was then called the Alleanza Nazionale, and its leader was a man called Gianfranco Fini, who ended up being one of the most pro-EU politicians you could have wished for, more so, but I would add, than Berlusconi. And the interesting thing here is that one of the reasons Gianfranco Fini moved in that direction, I think, was that he was invited to take part in something. I don't know whether your memories go back. This was called the European Convention,
yes.
And it sat in roughly 2002-3 to draw up a constitution for the European Union.
One to four.
Okay. And anyway, he was invited to take part of it, despite his slight, you know, people sort of slightly held their nose a little bit when they heard his name. But he took it seriously, and he got interested in the whole thing, and he ended up rather believing in the project. So he was, as it were, tamed. And he served as finance minister, foreign minister, deputy prime minister. That is part of the origins of today's Fratelli d'Italia. Now, if you look at AFD, I mean, I don't know, I've yet to see an AFD politician who would sit on something equivalent to the European Convention, you know, have a constitution of Europe. So they're very, very different creatures. That is my point.
And I think there's a very fundamental difference between the Greens and the populist radical right, which is that the Greens have policy goals. They actually want policies in place to do something quite fundamental, which is to change to a sustainable economy. And therefore, although there were big differences always between the Greens, you know, from the early 90s onwards, you have the Fundies and you have the light Greens and those who think that you can have green capitalism and those who think you need a completely different kind of economy. But fundamentally, that meant that there were things they want the EU to do and there are things they want national governments to do quite specifically to achieve those policy goals. Whereas the populist radical right is adaptable. They're ideologically extremely flexible, and often they don't have a policy goal. Even on an issue like migration, which is their kind of touchstone, the EU doesn't have very many powers on migration, but mostly they don't want the EU to get involved on migration. They want it to be decided at national level, and their goals are primarily about restricting access to asylum, and then they have very different views on labour migration. But that's like one of the few issues on which they actually engage on policy. On most things, they're not engaging on policy. They don't have a goal which could be served by policy change.
So we've mentioned populist radical right quite a bit. We've talked about Maloney, we've talked about Le Pen, AFD, and so on. Going back to Thomas's question about the left, where is the left in all of this? What's left of the left, and what are they doing? How are they reacting to all of this? It looks like, looking at the polls, they're sort of kind of where they were and kind of holding steady in the big scheme of things. Looks like, you know, there's a social democratic chancellor in Germany, then, you know. What are the left up to, and what are they left with at the end of this election cycle?
And there's only four social democratic parties in the council now, no, out of 27. I mean, the left, of course, has been in long-term decline, and the big question is always, oh, you have a financial crisis, and you have all these economic crises, and why is the left not the solution? And I think Heather already sort of partly explained that, no, in terms of that they don't have fundamentally different prescription when it comes to, you know, the economy, or, you know, they're not sort of questioning it. So they're not the obvious solution if you're unhappy with the system as it is. But in a European setting, there is an interesting question about, given that they are, if you get a sort of median EPP, MEP, you know, why should they keep, and they are going to be mainly in opposition nationally, because of course before they were just very strong as a part of this grand centre-right, centre-left coalition. But now they're going to be mainly in opposition. There's not a lot of them left. I mean, probably won't get re-elected in Germany. Then there's Spain, then government.
Denmark,
obviously, they're already in a grand coalition there, and sort of policy-wise, quite
to the right.
Quite to the right. So this is, so what is in them? What is in it for them to like go in and, for example, support von der Leyen sort of enthusiastically? I mean, why don't they go all out and just be opposition? I mean, that's a sort of interesting question. If they're so weakened, because again, you have to think about it also in terms of the council, not just in terms of the European Parliament. If they're so weakened, why not just go all out and be a proper opposition? I mean, they probably won't do that.
Maybe it'll reinvigorate them.
A couple of things come to mind. I mean, one, there were many more governments of the left in power at the time of the financial crash.
Yes.
Around 2008 and 2010 onwards. Yeah. And I mean, what did the public, they saw, they go, well, look, you know, here's the left. They've just been sort of co-managers of a capitalist system that's came very, very close to falling apart. And then because it came so close to falling apart, you had these enormous bailouts of banks and the financial, and the left had basically said, yeah, we'll let it go, you know. And I think there was a sense there, well, you know, is this really what we won't have, you know, governments of the left to do? That's one thing I remember. So I think they suffered a lot from that episode. The second thing is just a more anecdotal thing, and it relates specifically to France, where I think the decline of the left has been absolutely staggering in recent years. So last September it was, actually, I went on holiday to an area in the far southwest, the département called the Aude, and I had a friend there, and she introduced me to a local mayor who'd been a socialist mayor of this little area. He's retired now, and he went through election results with me one evening. It was great fun, if you like looking at elections.
Was there any wine involved?
There was an awful lot of, yeah, there was.
That's how you want to be looking at elections.
Because
results.
What else do you do in Southwest France in September? Yeah. So anyway, but the basic story was that the socialists had commanded this area very comfortably all the way up to 2012. You do it by presidential election, first round presidential election result. And then, this is for the department as a whole, 2017, Macron won, and 2022, Le Pen won. So what you see is an area that was socialist moving to, you know, after the sort of despair surrounding Hollande's presidency. They moved to Macron because they think, you know, he looks like he's promising. And now, you know, he's a busted flush, and they vote, you know, Le Pen. And so related to that, there's although I can't tell you where I saw this, but there's some evidence to suggest that in the, I think it's Alsace, that the further a voter lives away from a wine-growing area, the more likely they are to vote extreme right. Now, that's very...
What kind of moderation is that?
No, so stay close to a vineyard. You know, that's what I'm saying.
All right.
But can, so don't you think, now we should ask Tony, so will journalists, you journalists, so on the 5th of July, will there be just a flurry of articles written, oh, the only place left in Europe where there's socialism and the left is strongest in Britain? Is that what we're going to get?
The benefit of Brexit finally comes out.
Well, you know, are they socialists?
No, but I don't think there is a, but that's, you know, I often get asked, oh, why are Brits so left-wing compared to the continent, which I think is false.
I think it is false. You know, one, I think if one looks at the during the Labour Party's existence as a whole, you know, what is it, 124 years, and the periods when they have been in power, one of the most interesting periods, and definitely I think the most successful, was the 1945 to 51 government under Clement Attlee. This has gone down in Labour Party legend as a great reforming government that all sorts of things, National Health Service and welfare state and, you know, nationalisations and all this. But here's the truth. Most of that legislative programme had been drawn up by Churchill's wartime coalition government, including the welfare state, which was actually drafted by a liberal politician called William Beveridge during the middle of the Second World War. The NHS also had been planned for. The big education reform had actually been passed under an act in 1944 by known as the Butler Act, after a Tory party. So what you saw in this period that is celebrated as a wonderful Labour era for the Labour Party was actually them fulfilling something that, for which there was a broad consensus across the whole of the British political spectrum. And I think that's quite important when you look. When they get absolutely annihilated by the British electorate is when they stand for something like Jeremy Corbyn stood for. You know?
So, but isn't that also now, and in a sense, if we look at them, is there a broad consensus, no?
Well,
on policy.
With a consensus with the Tories on economic.
Or Tory consensus with Labour. You know, in the sense that they have sort of bought into the NHS and the welfare. Just think, this will come out, no, because we're going to have these two contrasting elections. Mm. We're going to have Europe looking like it's moving to the right, and Britain looking like it's moving to the left.
I don't really see it as Britain moving to the left. I see it much more as a sweeping condemnation of the incompetence and sort of faux populism of the Tories since 2016.
Yeah, but also Britain has a two-party system, which most of the rest of Europe doesn't. So I think that also makes a difference, that Labour can contain a multitude of different views, nominally left-right, because you've only got this cleavage between two parties. The Conservatives also contains multiple views. Whereas where you've got multi-party systems, those differences of view are not subsumed under one party, they are contained within different parties. And then you get into the party list system. And, you know, it's complicated. If you're a Dutch voter voting today, as the Dutch have been doing for the European Parliament elections, there are two liberal parties. And how different are they? Which one is more left than the other? I mean, I would argue that D66 is so far to the left of British Labour that they should be considered socialist, but they're actually considered a liberal party. So I think these divisions, and here I might have something really quite controversial to say about the European Parliament. The European Parliament was formed on the basis of the idea that there was a clear cleavage of different interests in Europe between left, right, and then you could have liberals, you could have greens, you could have the far right, you could accommodate a third, and maybe more. But the idea was that there were very clear cleavages of interest in the European population, which could then be, you could make a compromise on issues, as the Parliament does, in order to pass legislation that represented the views of all of these different voters, and therefore there would be something for everybody in the outcome, right? That was the idea. It was absolutely the opposite of the British first-past-the-post, winner-takes-all, majoritarian government. The European Parliament is supposed to be a parliament of many parties and many views that come to, in the end, a compromise proposal that can actually serve the broadest European interest. But that doesn't... But the problem is now, what are those interests when you don't have what Zara was talking about at the beginning, a sense of people, like I'm a lifelong socialist and my father and grandfather were socialists, and that's the kind of economic class we come from, and that's our ideology, and no, I'm a conservative and so were my ancestors because we're landowners. That cleavage of I'm clearly a socialist or a Christian Democrat, that has broken down, and that means that who exactly do the Party of European Socialists, who or the EPP, who do these party groupings actually represent in an era of floating voters and very different preference formations among voters? It's becoming much more complicated and difficult to justify, which is not to say that we shouldn't have a European Parliament. I think it's still useful to have. But as a voice of the people, I think we need to be able to get beyond the idea that there are very clear party cleavages, because on many issues there aren't. And also, the most important thing, which I started with this evening, is turnout. Because how can it be the voice of the people if you've got so few people actually participating in the elections? Now, five countries have introduced the vote for 16, 17-year-olds. I hope some of you in this room might be those who've actually voted. But I would say that that's the most important thing now.
Thank you very much. So we have a couple of minutes left. Are there any other burning questions on the floor here? Oh, I see some burning questions. There's several hands up. So maybe we can do kind of a quick round, keep the questions short and pithy.
Hi, I'm interrupting this event to tell you about another awesome LSE podcast that we think you'd enjoy. LSE IQ asks social scientists and other experts to answer one intelligent question, like, why do people believe in conspiracy theories? Or, can we afford the super rich? Come check us out. Just search for LSE IQ wherever you get your podcasts. Now, back to the event.
Hi. Yep, Francis Pham from King's College right across the road. A lot of you have touched on many things that I think go towards the criticism of the EU as having a democratic deficit. Do you think that this criticism is legitimate, and if so, what is to be done about it?
Okay. Over here. a Dutch voter.
Hi, Lauren Ewai. I have a question about 1 in 4 European Parliament members have been part of scandals. What does this see as a challenge? Is this a challenge ahead? And does this also maybe show that the European Parliament is seen now internationally as more of an interest, given that they're trying to have more influence through these ways?
Democracy deficit, corruption.
Hi, thank you. My name is Veronica. I'm from the Department of Government. My question is, if the right-wing and right-wing populists indeed gain more power in the next term, how do you think that's going to influence the actions and rule of law procedures against Hungary? Like, do you think they're going to support Orban, or is there a scenario in which they kind of try to show an alternative right-wing populism that doesn't violate these fundamental values of the EU? Thank you.
Oh, we've got some very big questions already. Maybe collect one more. I think over here there was one more hand, and then we'll have to get to the end of it.
Hi, I'm Max, also from the Department of Government. I have a question for Dr. Grabe. You mentioned that the EU is, due to its structure, pretty poorly positioned to provide many of the things people care about. And one of the things it might actually be well positioned for, arguably, is defense or security. Why, in your opinion, do you think that EU parliamentarians or commissioners are not jumping at the opportunity to really prove to voters that this is an area where they can make a difference and have sort of unique selling point and sort of, I don't know, create EU border force or EU army? Why is that not something that really motivates EU parliamentarians to show action?
Okay, so I'm going to assign the answers. I'm going to give Hungary to Tony. I'm going to give defense to Heather, and then democracy deficit and MEPs and corruption. Sorry. 15 seconds. No, I'm kidding. see if you can do it pithily. Hungary, go.
Right. Briefly, yes, I would expect parties of the type you mentioned to be sympathetic to protecting Orban's Hungary, yes. What more can I say? Yeah, I think there's a real risk of that, yeah.
But I think the flip side is that the council is getting much tougher on Orban. A notable number of foreign ministers and prime ministers now saying, hey, we can't allow our taxpayers' money to be siphoned off with corruption. So I think the Parliament started and the Council was very reluctant to act, and now I think it's shifted around the
other way.
But on defence and security, so this is really the scope of the new Defence Commissioner's role could be primarily about joint procurement of armaments, because that's an area where, you know, the defence experts have been saying for decades that the EU, the European governments, the European members of NATO need to get their act together in just becoming much more efficient in how they use their resources in defence spending. So instead of everybody having different tanks and different aircraft, they should have interoperable ones. Also, they shouldn't allow the defence companies to fleece taxpayers by having completely bespoke armoured vehicles when they could actually just produce a standard model for everybody at a much lower price. So this whole question of defence procurement is, I think, at the heart of all of this. Both procurement of lots more shells for Ukraine much faster, but also procurement of defence equipment for territorial defence in the EU, including things like drones and so on, at a lower cost. So that may be just the scope of the role, and it might be that the Member States don't actually allow the Defence Commissioner, or as they have not allowed the High Representative for Foreign and Security Policy, to go much further on defence, because they've still kept that as very much a national competence in terms of strategic thinking and decisions about threats and intelligence and all these kinds of things.
Sarah, democracy,
so,
representation.
So I think I sort of partly answered that I don't think the European Parliament has fulfilled its role. I was on this panel with Simon Hicks discussing similar things last week, and he was asked, does the European Union still have a democratic deficit? And he's written about it, and he said, no. And I said, I don't understand how the European Union doesn't suffer from all the things he identified it suffered from, you know, back in 2006. But part of it, of course, is how you conceptualize, you know, what is a democracy. And in terms of the accountability that we talked about, and that also goes to the to the question about scandals and corruption. Part of it is that although the EU now has more transparency, it still suffers in terms of accountability. Like, how do we, you know, throw out the rascals? Maybe it's a very kind of Anglo-Saxon way, but I still think it's partly important that you have an outlet that when you're unhappy with things, you can change politicians. And I still think that's a weakness in the EU. However, of course, it's part of the other thing is what's the benchmark? Does that mean that national democracies work perfectly? Does it mean the alternative is that it's better if there's no citizen involvement? No, I don't think so. So, I mean, I guess the answer to more accountability would be to have, you know, clearer, more competition and a clearer link between parliament and the executive. And we tried that and it wasn't an amazing success. But that would still be my answer.
So I know we're out of time, but I had a personal question here at the end, really quickly. Is there anything that you're looking for? Any surprises that might come our way? Because I've heard a lot of things tonight where I'd say there's quite a bit of consensus here where people are saying, I think we're going to see a shift to the right. I think we're going to see the sort of predictable consequences that come from this in terms of how we might deal with enlargement or migration or the climate and things like that. In terms of the election itself, any surprises you're looking for?
I will be looking for the coalitions that form afterwards. I think that's really both around von der Leyen. I think there could be some surprises. She looks like she's going to have a clean run because her group will do well and the right will do well, but that's interesting what will happen. And then again, in terms of the centre, how willing is the EPP to work with the radical right? I think it's European politics is all about coalitions, so in a sense, that part is more interesting to me than the election outcomes. Mm-hmm. Although I will enjoy it immensely on Sunday night. All stay up, watch it. It's going to be amazing.
Of course it will, yes. Honey?
You know, the surprise is going to be something that none of us can predict right now. What I mean by that is, you know, let's take the last three European Parliament elections. I mean, in May 2009, did anybody predict the sovereign debt banking crisis? You know, 2014, did anyone predict Brexit or Trump winning or the migration wave of 2015? And last time, who predicted COVID? And some did predict Putin would be aggressive in Ukraine, actually, not in Western Europe, but in Central they did. So what I'm saying is something is going to happen, but I haven't got any idea what it's going to be. I have this horrible feeling it's going to be something to do with artificial intelligence, actually. But I don't, I'm not, since I'm an absolute novice at that, what it might be, I've got no idea. But something,
we could ask ChatGPT to tell us.
Yeah.
Yes, Heather, other than turnout.
I'm wondering about the deep fakes for the candidates. Well, I think that there could be a cliffhanger about von der Leyen's appointment, about the appointment to the Commission President, actually. I think it's because, remember, she only got through the European Parliament with 9 votes the last time around. Very tight, and it could be much tighter still because
it's a secret ballot.
And it's a secret ballot, so the EPP has plenty of people who are really annoyed with her. So, you know, it's not like the EPP can be guaranteed to promote her. And there'd be the problem is when you're a new person who's suddenly just dropped in by the Chancellor of Germany, nobody really knows you very much. They'll give you the benefit of the doubt. When you've been there for 5 years, you will have annoyed people, lots of people, on different issues for contradictory reasons. So I think it could be a real cliffhanger, and we might see the same thing happening again, that the council ends up coming out with a dark horse whom nobody expected, like, say, Mario Draghi, whom Meloni could probably live with, and who doesn't have an obvious party affiliation. So I would predict one is the appointments could be a very rough ride, and it could take a while, so it might not be just a clear thing. And the second thing is I really want to know whether the 16 to 30-year-olds continue to vote green. Because Eurobarometer did a poll, the last poll before the election, where it showed that climate is still top priority for that age group. But will they, A, will they turn out? But B, will they continue to vote green, or will they be attracted by the populists of various kinds?
All right. Well, that is a really interesting ending for all of us. Thank you very much for listening, for coming. It was a super interesting panel. Thank you for the participation and for coming tonight. We'll see you another time.
Thank you for listening. You can subscribe to the LSE Events podcast on your favorite podcast app and help other listeners discover us by leaving a review. Visit lse.ac.uk/events to find out what's on next. We hope you join us at another LSE event soon.